On today's Jury Break, we're talking to a movie podcaster and friend of mine named Jonathan Young. He specializes in movie research, and I wanted to spend time this season exploring the movie Something's Got to Give. It's important in the story of Marilyn Monroe's death. It was the last picture in which she performed. She died before it finished filming. It is the film from which she was fired and over which she was then criticized in the press. And I feel that her relationship with this movie is integral in any discussion about her depression, substance abuse, and the possibility that she committed suicide. Our conversation lasted an hour and 45 minutes, and so this is being released as a two-parter. What I think is special that evolved naturally over the talk is that we went from the specifics of the movie itself, the plot, the budget, the cast, scene breakdowns, etc., to the larger landscape of Marilyn's history in Hollywood, and then farther down into her childhood and early life. A sort of, we burrowed deeper and deeper in this effort to understand how she wound up where she did on this movie set, or not on the movie set, as the case may be. I've posted a link to the unfinished picture, all of the archival footage from Something's Got to Give, which is viewable on YouTube, from my Twitter at DeliberationPod and on Facebook at DeliberationsPod. It'll give you a greater context, so if you're interested and get a chance, definitely check it out. And enjoy the interview.
Let's set the scene for listeners.
Oh, please.
We're sitting in my studio. Mm-hmm. I believe this is the first interview I've ever conducted here.
I am honored.
It's a very
honestly.
Oh, thank you. It's a very dark room. I've got some lights going on, mm-hmm. but there's an ambiance I feel in here at the moment.
Yeah, it'll make it like murder.
A little bit murdery. It's definitely a murdery room.
It's very appropriate. I mean, it's for your show.
It's dark. There's hooks everywhere.
There is.
And
You know, there's packing blankets and
packing
everything.
Packing blankets lining the walls, like, and the ceiling.
To, you know, for the blood.
Yes.
I get it.
Yeah. Totally purposeful. And we're sipping on martinis.
Absolutely. Cheers, by the way. To a very successful first interview. Just going to say it now.
First, not to be the last. Guys, I'm sitting with Jonathan Young of the amazing podcast Bombs Away.
Hello.
It's a comedic movie podcast that is completely amusing in a way other movie podcasts don't come close to. I'm going to let you, would you like to explain Bombs Away for?
Sure. So Bombs Away came as kind of this brainchild of mine of the first two jobs that I ever worked at was, one, I was a junior in high school, worked at a movie theater. So that was 1999. That was like the year of like Sixth Sense and like Phantom Menace and like these really huge, memorable blockbusters, right?
Right.
Lived the whole summer in that theater. And then immediately after that, I moved on in my senior year to work 3 years at a Blockbuster Video. Right. And my entire life was spent like you get 5 free rentals a week. And after a while, you'd be like, well, I don't like anything that's on the outside perimeter wall. You know, the outside was new releases. Right. So let's dive deep into the centers. Right.
Right.
And that's where you found the most craziest, wildest VHS covers you had ever seen for like poster art for stuff. You're like, what is this? Like, I have to. And then you flip it over. And then the backside description and the pictures were just as crazy. And that's where I discovered my love of crazy B movies and things that either went over budget or were like extremely under budget and like didn't have a life or a successful run other than in VHS stores.
Right.
Right? So.
And so that's funny. Your budgetary interest is maybe plays into why you think Cleopatra is such an interesting story, which we'll get to later.
Exactly.
Okay,
right?
Okay.
So, like, you have things that either overly inflated and were horrible bombs, right?
Right.
Which is where the title comes from. Or you had things that were never given enough money to become anything successful and they became bombs.
Right.
So, Bombs Away is we basically sit down and we make fun of films from our past that were either critical, financial, or commercial bombs in movie history.
Right.
And we do it in such a way that no plot point is left unseen, mm-hmm. unspoken about, numerous comedic tangents, and just one hell of a wild ride in the vein of, say, Joe Bob Briggs or Elvira from back in the day.
Oh, yeah, love Elvira.
Yep.
Yeah, yours is a, it's a really fun show.
Thank you.
I encourage everyone to go check this out. And so I brought you on today to be our movie expert. I'm now going to make you into my resident movie expert.
Sure, you can call on me at any time.
I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
I'm dubbing you.
Wow. Okay.
And
all right.
And you're now accountable.
Well, yeah, right. Good luck. It's just a bunch of bad movies. So. No. So I mean, I have a rich...
You know a lot about movies.
Love
you know
of history.
You're very knowledgeable. You do a lot of research. And you're very well informed when it
kind
comes
of OCD
to movie
about
making
it, honestly.
In a great way. And I... So this season is based on the story of Marilyn Monroe. And she was in the middle of shooting a picture called Something's Gotta Give.
Mm-hmm.
At the time
Not the Jack Nicholson one.
Not the Jack Nicholson one with Diane Keaton, which I've also
no,
seen.
No, that's... No, it's not Diane Keaton.
Yes, it is.
Wait, no.
It totally is.
Something's Gotta Give?
Something's Gotta Give was with Jack Nicholson, Diane Keaton, and Amanda Peet.
No.
Yes.
Something's Gotta Give, is that not... Wait, which one is the one where he's got the dog with the bacon?
That is...
I am wrong.
As good as it gets.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Three words, you know?
So we're both movie experts.
No, you're right. You're right. I never saw Something's Gotta Give. I just knew it was Keaton.
Generic movie titles. Like, everything's like...
Well,
you know,
somewhere along, I'd say, like, Keaton's, like, 50-year range, like, it was just like... middle-aged guy comes to terms with like actual discovering like life and joy, mm-hmm. right? And that's like both of those films, right?
That's true. That's completely true. The landscape is different. One is OCD,
right?
And one is just like playboy, successful.
But that's
bachelor.
Hollywood loves that kind of film. Like, look at I haven't even seen it, but like the trailer alone. For like the Christopher Robin movie is like Christopher Robin used to love like poo and everything and then grew up and now he needs to rediscover poo and everything and rediscover childhood.
I want to see that movie so
you know
badly.
What I mean?
I want to see it so badly.
Yeah.
It looks really good.
Oh, no doubt. Like, I'm sure it was. I just happened to skip it.
But you're right. It is very formulaic. And why are there no movies about women made in that context?
Oh, because I believe that women continually... discover, you know, their youth and keep the fires burning and alive. I feel like men somewhere hit some sort of plateau and are like, oh, I'm depressed and my life sucks and they need their...
That's a positive female-friendly view of things. Thank you.
Hey,
it's not even... a movie industry move.
You're right. Like, because like every single CEO of a Hollywood studio is like, that's how I feel right now.
Exactly.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's one take on it, honestly. I think it really comes down to more or less just Hollywood just dishing out the same stuff. They've been doing it for years.
Right.
And honestly, like, one of the main topics that we're talking about today is something that I'm kind of thankful that they don't really dish out a lot more of when it comes to, like, epic, like... historical pictures. Like, I've never been interested in them. I can absolutely see why, like, Cleopatra bombed. And,
right. Well, okay, so
yeah.
A lot of listeners don't know how Cleopatra plays into this. So let's break it down.
Okay.
Okay. So Marilyn Monroe
go ahead.
Was cast in a film called Something's Gotta Give. And she was cast in this film because she had one remaining picture on her contract with Fox.
Mm-hmm.
And she had to complete it, and she was being paid one-tenth the salary of Elizabeth Taylor. Yeah,
yep.
$100,000 she was being paid, which was one-tenth of what Elizabeth Taylor was being paid for a picture that was being filmed at the same time called Cleopatra.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mind you, Cleopatra's had been filming or even started pre-production in like 68, 69, and now here we are in 62.
You mean 58, 59.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Sorry. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now here we are at 62. So it's just,
okay,
it's
yeah.
such an interesting thing. We're like, what we'll go into, at least from what I have for Cleopatra, is the fact that it just kept going and just ate up this entire amount of money.
Right.
Yeah.
So these two stars, Marilyn Monroe and Elizabeth Taylor, at the time, they were both bombshells, sex symbols, big box office draws.
Huge.
Marilyn's last couple hadn't done as well, but she was still one of the biggest stars in the entire world. And they drew an enormous crowd, enormous interest. And Fox was bleeding money on Cleopatra, and it needed to get some revenue. And it had Marilyn on the ropes for this one last picture. They could get her dirt cheap, comparatively speaking. And it was a comedy. It was a what was called a bedroom comedy, which was common in the 1960s. And Marilyn had some authority when it came to decision making in her contract. She decided to she approved. She had approvals. She approved Dean Martin to be her co-star.
Right.
She approved George Cukor to be the director, who also directed Gone with the Wind, for context. Very respectable people. And Sid Charisse was another actress in the movie. The plot was, let's break it down. The plot was that Dean Martin, his wife was Marilyn Monroe. This is backstory. She went off on a boat trip.
She went to be a photographer on a boat trip.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
mind you, like, because you had given me, I had never seen this film or like basically the footage. It's not a complete film. It's about 37 minutes worth of footage that was usable. That like,
right, the unfinished right. picture,
and
the footage.
What I
from
got
it.
From it is that, and mind you, like it, because only certain, and they didn't film in order, so it wasn't like I was watching something that then led up to like, oh, cut, like we're done
you could,
here,
you couldn't
right?
see the whole chronology of the
I
story.
Could see a little bit, and I could see where like the editors who like found the footage like tried to piece something together, and what I could gain from it is that, and a lot of this was described in like attempted comedic dialogue between Dean Martin and the judge.
Right.
Which was so weird. That scene is so weird
to me. That's the scene that starts the movie.
Right.
And
which I don't think was the original start of the film, honestly.
I don't know. I think it might have been because Marilyn Monroe, actually, she had script approval.
Okay.
And she really took a hatchet to the script, and she required it be rewritten time and time and time again. There were several script writers that were brought on to redo the script that she found to be unacceptable, various scripts she found to be unacceptable. And so it wound up being a very weird, patchy, story.
From what I saw on screen, I could say that it still wasn't fixed.
Right.
Honestly. I mean, there were like genuine, like really like adorable, fun moments with her and everything. But I think like that is also just part of who she is and like how what she brought to the screen. But like when I'm watching this first line of dialogue that we're getting into, it's just it seems one very stinted, and people are also like for some reason agitated and angry at each other in this first scene. Like the judge, it almost seems like there's a scene where the judge had a long day prior to this because he's just angry at Dean. He's angry at his new future wife.
Right.
But she's also annoying him via like a mirror that's like flashing in his face.
Yeah.
I don't know what's happening.
It's very odd. I'm going to set the scene. So the movie opens and Dean Martin and Sid Charisse are waiting to see the judge. It's basically an empty courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
And what Dean Martin is trying to accomplish is that he wants his wife declared dead. His
Correct.
Wife went off on a boat trip as a photographer, and she was
lost at sea. Yeah.
Never seen or heard from again. That was 5 years ago. Since then, he's met Sid Charisse, and he wants to be married to her. And so he needs Marilyn Monroe to be declared dead so that he can legally marry Sid Charisse.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why he's seeing the judge. And it's an awkward scene.
Yeah.
It's an awkward scene.
Mostly because it's still in this like perceived time of being like, oh, your wife was just declared dead like right now and you want to get married? And it's like,
Yeah.
All right, 60s, calm down. You know,
yeah, 60s were a crazy
right?
time.
Everybody, calm down. Your perception, right. Like it's been 5 years.
I don't think the movie would have been very successful had it been completed.
I honestly don't either.
Marilyn Monroe was very image conscious. To her credit, you know, she understood that she knew what she wanted.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted to be a sex symbol. There were times when she would send back rewrites of the script, and she would say, "This version doesn't work." Marilyn Monroe does not chase a man. The man needs to chase Marilyn Monroe. And so she's playing this character.
I mean, touche, though.
Right.
I mean, that's how it should be.
Right.
I
mean, but she comes, but she, in the story, she comes into this world where Dean Martin's moved on to another woman, mm-hmm. and she's like, hey, you've got to come back to me. And the comedy is supposed to come from the fact that this man is divided between two wives that he suddenly has.
Right.
And she was very, she was more concerned about her image than the integrity of the story.
Sure.
And she needed, you know, to be like a sexual draw throughout mm-hmm. the entire storyline. And it really just complicated what the joke should have been.
Oh yeah, because what it becomes is, from the footage that we got. Right, you have Marilyn Monroe, who literally just shows up on her husband's doorstep, right,
mm-hmm.
and sees her children, who I guess were too young to know who she was, right, so don't even recognize her, right? She's playing with them, but because we have no context and there's probably scenes missing, she kind of seems like a crazy person that just walked into the backyard and started playing with children.
Yeah,
right.
That's true.
But she's like, it's one of those things where you, as an audience member, and if you knew any history on this, you're watching, you're like, oh, this is a mother like with her kids. But like, also you have to look at it from the outside of being like, what if I didn't? You're like, is a really loony like like woman who's like, do you want me to stay with you guys? I'll stay with you guys. And it's like, no, we don't even know who you
yeah.
are.
And you lay flowers at your mother's grave every year. Tell me about that.
Yeah, like, please do elaborate on your dead mom.
Why are these tiny kids alone in the backyard swimming? There are no adults there.
I don't know, because then out of nowhere, she basically assumes the role of their like Swedish nanny.
Yeah.
So basically Dean Martin and his new wife show up from honeymoon, right? Which, okay, they were on honeymoon, but where's the kids' caretaker? Like,
right.
That's missing.
Right.
Right? And immediately he knows who she is, right? But
mm-hmm.
the new wife doesn't, and she presents herself at the Swiss nanny, and then all the rest of the scenes are like one Dean Martin trying to he figures out that she wasn't alone on the island. There was like another dude, right?
Right.
And then he gets super jealous over that, where it's like, well, dude, you're remarried. You actually were sleeping with another person. Like,
right.
You don't know if she was, right?
Right.
But he's
well,
super
maybe
jealous.
Not. I think in 1962 they probably would have kept alive the idea that they hadn't slept
before marriage. Right? Which, no,
she...
you're right. This did happen that way because, like, remember she talks to a psychiatrist, that new wife talks to a psychiatrist, and there is this innuendo conversation where neither one of them says the words like sex, have you done anything, like anything that would be taboo. They don't
right.
say it. He goes,
but
have you? And she's like,
amorous.
Uh-huh. And did
yeah.
you try? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then like, did he? Uh-uh. Right. So
right.
I think he's been loyal to his dead wife the whole
right.
time. So
right.
you're right there.
So she showed up just in time.
I know,
as
right.
a weird Swedish nanny character.
Right.
It's a weird movie.
It's so weird. And like to get back to the point of where you said like a man should chase after her, she does do what was then considered, and it was huge for marketing of this film, like something brand new that she'd never done on screen. Like before this, she had done the iconic, like the great blowing up her skirt scene and things like that,
yeah.
but she had never done on-screen nudity.
That, okay, so recently, and I mean recently,
mm-hmm.
within the past few months
yeah.
of 2018.
Yeah.
It was discovered that she had filmed a nude scene for The Misfits, which
mm-hmm.
was the last picture she had done, but it was never included in the film. It was
Got
cut,
it.
Left on the cutting room floor. So she still had not, you're right,
mm-hmm.
done a nude scene, and this would have marked the first nude scene of an A-list star.
And it was used as publicity
yes.
for a film that hadn't even come out yet.
Right.
So basically... The day, so the little context in this scene, the cinematographer was like, I can see her nude bra, like, underneath the water. Like, I can see it.
And, right, and let's break it. So she, yeah. The nude scene occurs because it's nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
Dean Martin and Sid Charisse are upstairs in the bedroom. Marilyn Monroe is
trying to... Sid's trying to get it, too.
Yeah, she is.
Right.
And Marilyn Monroe is trying to... convince her husband to tell his new wife that she's come back and
right.
leave her, you know, abandon the new wife and come back to her and just be generally seductive. And so Dean Martin looks out his window and he sees Marilyn Monroe frolicking,
skinny dipping
in their pool and flirting and laughing and, oh, come in, the water's fine. Mm-hmm. And he's like, shh, oh, hush, 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 like, you know, worried that Citrice is going to discover her, like, being naked in their pool, in her own pool, I assume, I guess.
Maybe, I don't know. She knew where the house is. Right. I guess it was their house.
But her body was bananas.
Oh, it's insane.
It's insane.
Okay, because... if I was a guy in 1960, and so, like, if this film had come out, because, like, I will be 100% honest, like, I do not follow the films of Marilyn.
Okay.
I just don't, right? So
you're fired.
I know, right? You're like, you're not an expert at all. You're yeah. this guy lied to me. No, I mean, and they're part of it is like the first job that I had here coming in California was I worked at Universal.
Okay.
And so like I actually had to escort Marilyn around, quote Marilyn, right? You know, because she's a character at Universal.
I see.
Right?
I see.
And
wait. Do I see? What do you mean by that?
She's a character at Universal.
Wait, meaning that you had to speak to her?
I had to escort her around to take photos and protect her from tourists that would then take photos with her.
I'm very confused. You're talking about a Marilyn Monroe lookalike? Like,
okay, so...
dressing up like Marilyn?
You know Mickey Mouse, right?
Yes.
Right? So Mickey Mouse goes around the park... and he has an escort with him to make sure that he's safe and that people are calm and cool and collected when they take photos with him.
Oh, I never realized there were...
there's people in, like, vests
escorts.
And suits and to make sure nobody messes with Mickey, you know, because Mickey, you know, has a job to do and, you know, this is a delicate subject for me to talk without breaking magic. but same thing is that Marilyn would walk around just like the princesses at Disney. Marilyn would walk around Universal.
Oh.
Same with Lucille Ball.
Okay.
And they would need escorts to make sure that...
you were that guy.
I was one of those guys. It was one of the first jobs I had in California. Yep.
You just watched...
I'm a...
Marilyn.
Character attendant, they call it.
Damn.
Yes.
That's
actually, they call it production assistant.
A crazy job.
But that doesn't make any sense because I'm not actually a production assistant in the sense of an actual film.
Right.
But yeah.
But they call all their employees cast members.
Disney does.
Disney.
Yeah. Because I'm a cast
Universal.
Member.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. That's
still that's a.
That's why I'm like treading
job.
Lightly of being like, what do I say?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds like you know Mickey, right?
Right.
That,
yes.
That 5'1" mouse that walks around the park.
Right. okay.
Yeah. So Marilyn was one of those characters, right?
Right.
And for a long time, I was just like, I'm around her all day as a character, as a persona, right? Like, I don't want to go home and watch these films. Like, and I just never did.
Yeah, you were Marilyn overdosed.
Yeah, I was.
But you were familiar with Marilyn.
Oh, absolutely.
Everyone knows who she is.
Right.
And you were her escort.
Right.
So you got to know her pretty well in that regard.
And so when it comes to this film and seeing her, and I had seen a couple clips of previous things, and they said that for this film, she had even dropped 15 pounds and that she was in the best shape and the best looking
it's true.
Of
and
her life.
I'll provide some context to that. So she was married to Arthur Miller. And
her third marriage,
and they were trying to have children. And tragically, she, you know, wanted them desperately, but was unable to carry a baby to term. And she, there are reports that throughout her life, she had undergone something between 9 to 12 abortions. I'm not sure if that's true. I'm not sure if that would
I heard
impact
on record
her
three
ability
at
to
least.
Conceive.
Okay. Yeah.
But I do know that she was trying to have children with Arthur Miller, and for whatever reason, she was unable to do so. And I think part of the depression she experienced during that marriage and part of, like, her off and on, like pregnancy, you know, attempts.
Sure.
She'd put on some weight during that marriage, and that was when she filmed Let's Make Love and The Misfits. Let's mm-hmm. Make Love, especially, she was criticized at the time for having, like, put on a little bit of weight. She was still gorgeous. Her body was phenomenal.
Yeah, no, but I mean, even it's the difference. And when I say, because, like, it makes me come off as, I don't know, chauvinistic or whatever, right? Like,
right.
The difference between, like Marilyn in like, you're saying, like, what's it called? Let's Do It? I don't know. It's basically like, Let's Have Sex, right?
Wait, Something's Gotta Give?
No, the title of the
film.
Oh,
Let's Make Love.
Let's Make Love. Yeah,
yeah,
right.
Yes.
It's way classier than Let's Do It.
That's the 2018 version.
Yeah. Yeah, we got this picture coming out from Fox called Let's Do It. No, and that's the thing, is like just the difference between like that, where it's like voluptuous, beautiful woman, and then like in this Something's Gotta Give, where like 15 pounds, she turns into this like hourglass figure that almost knew that she had to do a nude pool scene.
Totally.
You
her
know?
Body is insane.
Banging.
Like,
banging.
Anyone looks at the stills from, or she did a screen test in a bikini. You mm-hmm. can find that stuff online. I might post it.
Do it.
She also did the nude pool scene. There are stills from that.
You should post that clip.
The footage. Yeah, I should.
Because it's
I've never seen a body like that. I can't look away.
Well, this is what I was trying to get to, but I apologize to all your listeners that, like, we are in tangent city when it comes to me.
Right.
So, like, if you don't like that about, you're not going to like the show that I do. I'm going to say, but like,
if you're annoyed by this episode,
I'm telling you, I know, right? Like, I don't like that guy. I'm telling you right now, like, this scene, and it's kind of where I was getting to, where I was like, this scene alone inspired me to be like, I got to watch all of her stuff now, right? Because, like, it's cute, it is flirty, mm-hmm. right? And that's the thing, is like, you're saying that she had script approval and she was like, a man shouldn't chase, you know, a man should chase me, not the opposite. And right. then she, like, in this scene alone, achieve that point where it's like, oh, I want him to chase me, so I'm going to flirt. And I'm going to flirt in the most, like, craziest way possible, right? Where it's like, I'm going to live in his house, right? And I'm literally just going to be like, there's a scene within this scene where she tries to climb out of the pool, kind of, mm-hmm. and her legs up on the side, and like literally she raised herself 2 inches more out of the water, you would have gotten a bottom flash.
Yes.
You know? And you're just like, wow. Like, and for some reason, it's not trashy. It's it's adorable.
It's that you're 60s like, sexy cute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it made me go, I need to watch all now.
Thank you. It's true. When it comes to her, she is so addictive. She's magnetic.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that I am just completely drawn to when it comes to Marilyn Monroe. She embodies so many qualities that are just so unbelievably enticing. And, you know, she's innocent mm-hmm. and she's devious.
Yeah.
And she's sexy as hell, and she's vulnerable.
By the way, so, like, I did a lot of research on her early years mm-hmm. as well. Have you seen, like, when she was married to her first husband, Darty?
Yeah.
Have you seen those images? Like, basically, when she was working for, like, the World War II, like, effort?
I have.
And, yeah, those, like, just those, like, here's the girl that's working in the factory, and this
right.
is how she got discovered. Like,
yes.
And she's not blonde, and she's just, like, this brunette that's just, like,
right.
and you're just
so
like, my
was,
God, she, like, gorgeous then, gorgeous yeah. now.
But, yeah, she
it's almost timeless.
When she was 16, she married Jim Doherty because otherwise she'd have to... There's something about her custodial
Her parents
care.
Basically were like, it's almost like an arranged marriage. Here's
right.
the guy next door.
Right. yeah, literally. Mm-hmm. But they were very fond of each other, and that's just the way it was done. And so she married. He went off to war. She got a job at a factory.
Mm-hmm. As you did.
A wartime
you know.
Effort.
Yeah.
And there was this photographer that came to the factory, and they were photographing the girls and
right.
to sort of like be inspirational, like, look at these cute girls, like,
yeah,
doing
you put
things
it in
the war.
You put it in the reel, like,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
War is broken out,
yeah,
you know, like,
totally.
You put that in the reel before,
yep.
you know.
And
I saw Roger Rabbit, I know,
you know all about it,
that's
love
all I
Roger
know.
Rabbit, and she was adorable. And so she got noticed, and a photographer was like, you should be a model. And here's my card. So she started modeling for this agency. Mm-hmm. And then someone told her she'd get more gigs if she dyed her hair blonde, because they were getting more requests for blondes. And so she did that. And then she started like building momentum. Jim Doherty was still off at war.
Yep.
And she wrote her husband and she told him, you know, I'm divorcing you. I'm going to pursue this thing.
Well, this was insane too, because at the age of 20, so basically she was seen in normal magazines, and then those normal magazines, like, people were saying that, like, that's not enough. Like, you need to go for, like, more of the, like, comic, the pulp magazines, right? Which is where, I guess, Howard Hughes was a fan of those said magazines and noticed her, right?
Oh.
And then 20th Century Fox, in just direct competition of being like, whatever Howard's doing, we want to do it better, right?
Right.
Saw her and then immediately signed her and then realized that they didn't know what to do with her and pretty much dropped her contract within a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then she went into just publicity stunts after that for a while.
Oh.
Like, she signed on to Columbia at 22.
Oh.
And then they had her as a burlesque dancer in a film called Ladies of the Chorus, right? Which she did her first solo number. But then they, like, failed to renew her contract, too. And that's when she basically, she had enough star power in magazine and photo shoots for people to go, hey, we want you to come here and do this ribbon cutting. We want you to do this birthday celebration here. So she
Is
was
that
like,
when she was Miss Cheesecake?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, like, that's when she started doing this. And then, like, 20th Century Fox, basically in 1950, was just like, we want you back, kind of thing, right? So she has this huge back and forth, like on again, off again relationship with not only like multiple partners and multiple like husbands, but also in her professional life with 20th Century Fox. Her entire life is intertwined with 20th Century Fox,
right?
Which is crazy because now they're not even a thing because Disney just bought them.
Oh, well.
Finally. Right?
That's interesting. I was about to say that what you just said, like, her biggest professional relationship, I really feel, was with 20th Century Fox. And she was embroiled in a complicated relationship with Fox at the time she died.
Mm-hmm.
And on that note, let's take a break and get a drink.
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely.
Okay, and then come back upstairs.
Cool.
Okay.
The world is changing. We've reached a time when we need things on demand, we get things on demand, and we appreciate things on demand. More and more, errands are becoming possible through digital means, saving time, energy, and in my case, allowing deadlines to be met and people to be paid on time. I know it's crazy, but a lot of people still don't know that postage is now possible on demand through the use of stamps.com. I used it myself, today, and frankly, it was the only way I found I was able to pay my actors responsibly in a timeline that was respectful to them. I'll tell you what I mean. On Monday, I recorded the final four episodes of my Jury, starting with episode 9. The following day, Tuesday, I recorded the interview you're listening to right now, and the next day, Wednesday, I needed to air episode 9. With all the prep, recording, backing up, editing, exporting, uploading, etc., I have been holed away in my bedroom studio on my computer trying to get everything up on time. After recording Monday, 4 of my actors requested their payment be made digitally, but the other 2 preferred paper checks mailed to them, which is great, but I had no postage. And it's amazing how just a simple errand that requires I leave my house during work hours can actually jeopardize a deadline. My actors are very sweet and probably would have understood a delay, but that's not the kind of producer I want to be. Actors rely on the money they get from gigs, and employers rely on services that make their workdays easier. So today, I used stamps.com to mail out their checks so they can receive their payments as soon as possible. I'm grateful to Stamps.com for providing a service that allows me to treat my cast as respectfully as possible while enabling me to continue working from home, which sometimes I need to do. It works right from your desk. You can buy and print real U.S. postage for any letter or any package.
It's all available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You just click, print, and mail. And you're done. Stamps.com will even send you a digital scale so you can send letters and packages, printing the exact amount of postage you need every time. Did I mention you can do this 24 hours a day? That's killer. Right now, use Deliberations for this special offer of a 4-week trial, which includes postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to stamps.com. And before you do anything else, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Deliberations. That's stamps.com. Hit the radio mic and enter Deliberations.
So where were we?
I don't know, but we were just framing. But now we're back, and we're back. We've been talking while we were mixing.
Yeah. So let's keep going with, like, because I want to paint a full picture for your audience of, like, who she was as a person and what led up to this.
Okay.
Right. So after Columbia failed to renew her contract and Fox was just like, hey, come back. Right. That's when they signed the big deal, which included this final picture, Something's Gotta Give, of basically being like, your final picture, you're agreeing to a $100,000 contract. Like, basically
payout. For five
payout.
Movies, I think it was.
Yeah, something like that, right? So she locked herself to a contract, and then she did Niagara with them, right?
I love them.
In 52, okay. Right? She did, in 53, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and got her her hands in the Grauman's Chinese,
yeah.
Right? So that was something,
point.
Right? Because
she
her
made a
and her mother
of what Jane Russell made on that movie,
right?
Yeah.
And something we haven't mentioned is like her actual like birth and her mother, right? So she was born obviously Norma Jean Baker in 1926.
Norma Jean Mortensen actually is
really?
On her birth certificate. Yeah.
Huh.
She would sometimes assume the surname Baker.
Hmm. Was that?
If anyone can hear a car alarm outside, I'm sorry.
No, they can't.
Okay.
I promise.
Okay.
Because you're good at this.
Mortensen was the name of her actual father, and that's the name that's on her birth certificate.
Got it.
But Gladys, her mother, actually misspelled Mortensen on her birth certificate,
okay.
Which leads you to believe maybe they weren't all that close. If she couldn't spell the name of the father of her child correctly on her birth certificate.
And I think you're absolutely right, because like the father just wasn't present. He just left them. And
right.
In this time, we're talking about the 20s. We're talking about like on the cusp of the Depression era. Like probably is more than likely way more
right.
popular than like, we want to admit.
Right. I do want to say...
So many skeletons in America's closet.
True.
If you guys aren't recognizing it.
I do want to say that I think that Marilyn... There were a lot of people in her life and in her childhood that cared about her. And she did...
Oh, for sure.
She did receive love in her childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Her mother was a diagnosed schizophrenic, and she unfortunately had to be hospitalized for her mental illness on more than one occasion.
And then she went to the care of Los Angeles. Yeah.
A Los Angeles orphanage. And I've seen it disputed by her own family whether or not she was actually in foster care. My personal belief is that she did enter foster care more than once.
Oh, I believe it.
I don't think it was 12 times, as she later asserted in her life. But I think that she was in and out of foster care a little bit. And
well, when it comes to a family legacy, they're going to dispute the negative parts.
Yeah, they just
constantly.
Want... Yes, yes, exactly. And I think that's what's happening right now. But... It was a hard childhood, you know? No
oh, sure.
father, a mother that was largely absent and sick.
Mm-hmm.
And
but when she did have her mother around, and that's where I was kind of pointing to here, is that they did go to, like, Grauman's and things
yeah.
like that. And then when her mother had to be committed again or passed at this point, there was
She died after Marilyn.
She did. Oh, okay. So then it was committed. Okay.
Yeah.
What I learned is that Marilyn basically was left alone again, like with an actual like family unit of some sort,
right.
and started creating her own fantasies of like how she wanted life to be. So when she is once she was there as a child, and now here she is an adult getting her own hands in the cement, which, by the way, I feel like it was way easier to get your hands in the cement back in the day, you know?
Well, there were fewer.
Well, I feel like we're out of room now. If you go there as a tourist, you're like, I don't, like, how could anybody have any more room in there, you know?
Right, right.
So, like, but it's so interesting because, like, as I go through this list here, right, until Niagara in 52, she, like, still was kind of just like, oh, there's that girl that shows up places and, you know, takes pictures and, like, is the pinup girl, right? Mm-hmm. And then 53, she does Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and immediately is like, here's your cement, you know?
Right.
It's such an interesting thing.
Now you're a star.
Right? It was just like, boom, star, you're good, right?
Yeah.
Hollywood is such a crazy thing, entity.
It's true. The term starlet was used a lot at the time. Starlet meaning an aspiring actress who was, I guess, B-level or under, C, D-level. But once you achieved, like, star status, suddenly you had a dressing room.
That was it. You had a chauffeur. You had a dressing room. You had, you know, last approval. Like, just all these things that just, even nowadays, I don't feel like is very, like, people don't treat stars like that, really. Like,
no, they
feel like everybody's just on the same level, you know? So
let's flash forward to...
Yeah, I wanted to, like, 54, she marries DiMaggio, has a 10-month marriage. Right. But is so big at this point. Right. That on their honeymoon, she gets asked to perform for the troops in Korea. They're in their honeymoon in Tokyo.
Yeah.
Gets asked to perform for 100,000 troops. Does 10 performances in 2 days. It's insane. The attention that she's getting.
That footage is in the public domain. So
yes.
I'll definitely post that.
Please do. Okay. Because, like, it's fascinating because she does in front. I've seen that footage with Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend.
Yes.
She performs in front of the troops and she actually visits them. Right. So she has this humanitarian side, a side that, like, if you read a couple of her letters, like, right before her death that we'll get into, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's this entire, like, there's an actual telegraph that speaks of her fighting for, like, actors' rights and stuff like that. We just want the opportunity to shine or something. Speaking of, like, stardom, right? And literally fighting, because this is not the first time, because this is what I'm about to mention, is that she, for many times, has fought for actors and, like, their rights on stage. So she wanted more of them to have a voice, because somewhere along the line after this, she divorces DiMaggio and she does the 7-Year Itch in 54.
Mm-hmm.
But then
that's the one with her when her skirt is blown.
Correct, right? That has the iconic great blowing scene. But after that, she walks out of the contract with Fox, right? And she does her own MMP production, so Marilyn Monroe Productions.
Yes, Milton Green.
Right.
Yes.
So, and this is her first attempt at, like, basically being like, I want to do independent stuff my way, like, and is fighting for it here, right then.
So for histories, she left L.A., she came to New York.
Correct.
She partnered with a man named Milton Green. They started Marilyn Monroe Productions, and she was going to be a serious businesswoman and take charge of her own career. This was also the time Milton Green actually introduced her to Lee Strasberg in the Actors Studio. So that's when she started becoming a serious student of acting under Lee Strasberg. It's also the time that she began seriously seeing Arthur Miller, who was an intellectual, highly respected for his mind in the, you know, in New York society and the world. And so all of this whole change happened. You know, she went from the cheesecake starlet in L.A. to the intellectual student, fiance, businesswoman in New York. And she really seemed to find herself what she wanted to be in New York.
Oh, yeah. And this is what's important, because, like, this is historically speaking for all actors now, even nowadays, right?
Okay.
Is that she finally got Fox to give in to, she was like, I will come back and I will make the rest of the pictures on my contract if you allow me to branch off and work with other studios. Okay, so she was the first person to basically make a major motion picture studio, like, break their whole, like, you are ours, we own you kind of situation, right? So that's historically speaking a huge thing, right? It gave actors the ability to finally say, like, I am able to choose the things that I want. You're not just going to pigeonhole me and peg me into like five movies and one of them's good and four of them are shit.
Okay.
That's extremely important, right? So after that, she goes on to marry Arthur Miller in 56, right? And then meets the Queen of England also in 56, which is hugely important.
Because she went to England right after she married Miller, she went to England to shoot The Prince and the Showgirl, co-starring Laurence Olivier,
mm-hmm.
who also directed the picture.
Right.
That's a good story, too. They made a movie about it, My Week with Marilyn, like, you know, because that whole production
I do remember
was a
that.
Shit show.
Yeah.
And she married the queen. Married the queen. She met the queen.
She married the queen.
She married the queen while she was in England.
What an honor. yes. And then in 57, her husband was placed on trial for contempt of Congress.
Yes.
And then she, while that was happening, has one of her more publicized miscarriages. Mm. Right. So there's this like downward spiral, right, where she got what she wanted professionally, the ability to like start working with Warner Brothers and go back to MGM if she wanted to, right? Personally, things were not working out. Her husband was now on trial, you know, and then you had mentioned, because this is where 58, she does Some Like It Hot, and then 1960, she does Let's Make Love, right? Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned that you actually have some details on what caused the Miller divorce.
I do. Okay. So real quick, 58, you said Some Like It Hot happened.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe her biggest, her most famous picture. I saw some statistic that said it was the most commonly played movie on TV historically. Like, it's been replayed the most times. Like, it's been seen a lot. Some Like It Hot, starring Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon and Marilyn Monroe. It's very good. It's set in the 20s. It's very funny. What's not funny about Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis and drag pretending to be?
I love Jack Lemmon.
I love all of those guys. I do love Jack Lemmon. 1960, Let's Make Love happened, which is a great movie, very underrated. I really enjoyed it. It stars Yves Montand, and she's who is a French actor. No one remembers. I didn't know him. She had an affair with him during the making of this movie, and it was at the It was at the end of her marriage with Miller. So I've read a lot and heard interviews with Arthur Miller, and I think I have a pretty firm grasp on what ended that marriage. And it wasn't just that she couldn't bear children. He already had children with his first wife. He wanted more, but I think that would not have been a nail in their coffin.
No, when I mentioned the children thing, I feel like that's more on her psyche.
Absolutely.
And that's absolutely. Like, building a case for you here.
Yeah. She's very emotionally fragile.
Mm-hmm.
And she needed a lot of not only emotional attention, but emotional affirmation.
Mm-hmm.
And she needed someone to be constantly tending to her and making her feel secure. And Arthur Miller was independent,
mm-hmm.
and
he also seemed from
emotionally
the,
drained.
Yeah, from the accounts that I've heard, also he seemed very controlling of her image as well, being like, "This is how you should look on this on the like." He was on set a lot more than he probably should have been.
Well, I think he had opinions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that those opinions were misguided necessarily. Like, I've seen letters that he wrote to her when she was starting Marilyn Monroe Productions, and mm-hmm. he would say things along the lines of, "I think Milton Green is becoming like too possessive of your, you know, like your name is what's selling this company,
right.
And you're giving away this much percentage of it to Milton Green, and you're giving him total control in this regard and that regard, and I just want to make sure you're taken care of." And there's no
hey,
one
welcome
seeming,
to Hollywood back
yeah,
then,
there's
too.
There's no one seemingly
like,
looking out for you,
yeah.
And I'm your romantic partner, and I don't mean to bring sexism into this, but like, I think he might have felt like, I'm the man, and there's no one looking out for you, and Milton Green seems to be taking advantage of
you. Well, you're not wrong.
I want to step in, and like, I want to like kind of guide you to make sure you're not taken advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I see, from reading those letters, that's the way I see it coming across. But he's spoken about the deterioration of their relationship, and he speaks to the fact that she was an emotional train wreck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look, I'm just going to be blunt. I'm going to
because here we are. Here we are about it. Like, here's everything. Like, we have painted a story for your listeners that leads up to something got to give. And that's what I was trying to do. The only thing that we haven't really touched on is Fox's situation with Cleopatra. At the same time,
right?
Which I can breeze through that pretty easily. But you're not
emotional.
Wrong about you can be blunt about this because it's very factual at this point.
Then I will.
Yeah.
She's an emotional train wreck.
Yeah.
She gets married to Arthur Miller. He thinks that she's just this darling, vulnerable, innocent starlet who needs protection. She wants to be considered a serious person, an intellectual, and he wants to mentor her in a sense. And they get together, and this relationship is based somewhat on that. And she dissolves, as she always does.
Arthur's trying to be the savior.
She's not emotionally,
yeah.
Yes. She needed a savior, but she didn't need a savior once. She needed a savior every day.
Yeah.
Dissolved. She could not attend to her work. She could not go to set without breaking down in fear.
Mm-hmm.
In fear of the way she'd be perceived, in fear that she wouldn't be good enough. She was,
which is one of the craziest things, because
affected.
I hear that, like, in that iconic nudity scene that we talk about in this final film, like, as soon as the cinematographer was like, I see your, you know, like, nude bra, she was like, well, it comes off. That's it. And she just jumped in the pool naked. It was like she was cool naked,
but
everything else apparently.
She's very comfortable with nudity.
Yeah.
She even filmed or recorded some, like, therapeutic sessions in her underwear. She would, you know, she would show, you know, nudity she was comfortable with.
Yeah. But I think it
was
performance-wise.
Her mind she wasn't comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And she, when it came to Arthur Miller and her life after she married him, you know, she was just so emotionally fragile. She needed so much care and attention, and he grew completely drained by her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wrote a short story called Please Don't Kill Anything about Marilyn Monroe because she was so moved, which is charming on its face. I'm so moved by anything being destroyed that I'm going to break down. But in reality, someone that fragile is a lot to tend to on a daily basis.
Oh, I can't disagree.
And Lee Strasberg was a big problem in their marriage as well. He was her acting coach. Paul Strasberg was her personal acting coach when Lee couldn't be there. And she became wholly reliant on their instruction. Laurence Olivier grew... So
I don't believe in these acting coaches. I never did.
Frustrated because during the shooting of The Prince and the Showgirl, which happened during Arthur Miller and Marilyn Monroe's honeymoon, or essentially, you know, right after their marriage.
That's the London one, right?
That's the London one.
Yeah.
So she's there, and Paula Strasberg is this crazy distraction on set and trying to instruct her in terms of her acting. But at one point, he hears her say, and she was method. Laurence Olivier is anti-method. And Paula Strasberg said to her,
I'm over here, like, my eyes went so far back in my head on when you said method. Because I'm like,
it's
just act or don't act. Like, just...
And and it's funny.
I'm such a cynical person when it comes to that. I'm like, just do it or don't.
You know what's funny about that?
What?
I'm breaking off just for a second.
No, please do.
I'm a little raw right now because we recorded our verdict yesterday for season 3, which I won't reveal.
No, please don't.
But it happened in this room, and there was a time, like, things got so heated versus guilty versus not guilty. And
good, that's the magic of your show, though, honestly.
Thank you. I wanted a verdict, and so I gave...
Did you have a hung jury?
I gave an instruction that we needed a verdict.
Okay.
And... It's still, and by this time, the actors were over time by 50 minutes, almost an hour, and they still couldn't come to a verdict. And one of the actors because they were so invested, they really wanted their side to win.
But that's fascinating, though. Like,
thank
I
you.
Love that.
Thank you.
Like, because that's, let me ask you, like, since we're on this little side tangent, for, and I think that this would be interesting for your listeners, like, a little behind the scenes, is that, like, is that something that, like, just comes naturally? Is that something that you need to happen? Do you need a verdict to happen, like, behind the scenes? Are you like, I need there to be a conclusion? Or are you willing to literally go on a second season in order to, like, cast a whole new jury if that one becomes hung? Have you ever thought about that?
I, you know, it's not about me, because I would be comfortable with a hung verdict.
Right.
But
I'm just curious,
I'm just
like,
to think
because
about, yeah, no,
your concept
I'm
is
glad
so
you asked me that.
Freaking fascinating.
Thank you. Thank
like,
you.
That's kind of how we met. But, yeah. You know, like, so you have people who you present the case, the story too, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you as an individual, as the creator, still have no control on the outcome.
I don't.
I think that is absolutely enthralling.
I was okay going either direction. And there came this point when we had a talk, you know, they could have gone in either direction. And it seemed like things were tipping in one way, but there were holdouts, and they were so emotionally invested that they'd rather sit. And they're being paid a day rate, so it's not like they're being paid by the hour, these
sure.
actors. And they'd rather sit there and argue and try to win than just, oh, call it quits for the day,
and
which means everything.
Like, you do realize that that's when you know that you have something special, something genuine.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, I think these performers were very special. But there was one point when someone said something to the effect of, like, well, you just need, we need to agree. We need a consensus because we need to deliver a verdict. Last season, a verdict was not delivered. And it felt imperative this season for a verdict to be delivered.
Mm-hmm.
And one actor leaned back in his chair and he said, and he was frustrated, and he, like, made a, you know, this is a podcast, you can't see me, but he made a gesture, and he just said one word to the holdouts, and he goes, act. And that meant a lot, you know, like, it beyond my investment in the story and the verdict, it was kind of a statement on performance, because some of them were method seeming.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, or just purely emotionally invested and didn't want the wrong message to be delivered to an audience. And the others were very technically driven.
Sure.
And we are playing characters right now, and we need to deliver a verdict.
So their own personal convictions were kind of coming in. And that's the kind of thing that, like, I think your listeners, like, may or may not know behind the scenes. And I think that's just equally as fascinating as just listening to the story, is the fact that you have people that are bringing in their own experiences. They're bringing in their own life stories and, like, everything that they have to the table as an actor. Right. And I think that's the same thing that Marilyn has done, because when you look at Something's Gotta Give, right, everybody describes the fact that she finally got to play a mother in this film. Right. So she's bringing her own, sense of, like, not being a mother, right, and what that would be like to actually want children. And she brought that to the screen in this final picture, right? So you have method actors who are passionately bringing their own convictions, their thoughts on how they would actually act as a juror, possibly acting off character to their own personality,
right?
And eventually there is a crossover. As a human being, I feel like, as an actor, there's a crossover. Like, you can't, unless you go, like, super, like, I don't know, the Joker in The Dark Knight, like, where you just, like, go so method that you go crazy and then you wind up actually physically killing yourself, you
right.
know? And that's that crazy, like, line, right? So, like, I find it fascinating that your actors are actually going through that, like, hard convictions of being like,
thank
what
you.
Are we presenting on air, right?
Yes.
So, great tangent. I know people are like, wow, that got deep, but it's super important.
Jonathan is right. It is important, and so I'd like to issue a personal thank you to my jurors who worked tirelessly and emotionally to give us all a fantastic ending this season. They were and are an extraordinary group. It takes a special skill set to assume a character and improvise a variety of arguments in support of that character's opinions. It's been a roller coaster of a week for me recording, but on next episode, I'm excited that you'll hear the defense's case laid out in its entirety. Please don't miss it. In the meantime, I'll be posting the following, all of which is discussed in this interview. The archival footage of Something's Gotta Give. Bikini stills from Marilyn's Something's Gotta Give screen test. Stills or footage from her famous Something's Got to Give nude pool scene. And the newsreel footage of Marilyn entertaining the troops during her DiMaggio honeymoon. I love Marilyn, and I love you, and I'm really looking forward to talking to you again next week. Thanks, you guys. Bye.